Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. Another mass shooting. Six people are killed at a Walmart in Chesapeake, Virginia, in the latest episode of gun violence in the U.S. Then, one-on-one, weeks after surviving an assassination attempt, former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan discusses the tenuous politics in his country and a potential return to power. And the tipping point, methane gas emissions from fossil fuel extraction severely exacerbate the already dire climate crisis.
We are harming the entire planet and every person and every living thing on it by what we're doing here in Texas. And we call this a climate bomb.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. On this night before Thanksgiving, there is shock and mourning in the southeastern Virginia city of Chesapeake. It now has now joined the long list of places in the United States where a lone gunman committed sudden mass murder. William Brangham begins our coverage.
Just after 10 p.m. last night, at this Walmart in Virginia's Tidewater area, a store employee named Andre Bing opened fire, killing at least six and then taking his own life. Governor Glenn Youngkin spoke this morning.
Our hearts are just completely broken this morning yet again in the Commonwealth of Virginia.
One employee recounted being in the break room when the gunman, who was a manager at the Chesapeake store, entered and started firing.
I looked up and my manager turned around and he just opened fire on everybody in the break room. And it is by the grace of God that a bullet missed me. Not gonna lie, I literally looked at him. I saw the smoke leaving the gun and I literally watched bodies drop.
Police found the shooter dead when they arrived. He'd worked at Walmart for over a decade and his motive remains unknown.
The Chesapeake Police SWAT team executed the search warrant at the suspect's residence. There's no risk to the public at this time.
This tragedy marks the seventh mass shooting in the past 7 days in America. The Gun Violence Archive, which tracks these tragedies, classifies a mass shooting as at least four people being injured or killed. They've documented more than 600 of these attacks so far this year. Virginia has seen its share this month after a University of Virginia student shot and killed three football players in Charlottesville less than 2 weeks ago. The Walmart killing deepened this fresh wound for many.
We have had two horrific acts of violence in the Commonwealth of Virginia in 2 weeks. And that absolutely brings with it a sense of anger, a sense of fear, a sense of deep, deep grief.
In a statement, President Biden also expressed his grief over the tragedies, calling the Chesapeake attack a horrific and senseless act of violence. The president again pushed for greater action on gun control measures. Late today, the police released the names of five of the victims: Lorenzo Gamble, Brian Pendleton, Kelly Pyle, Randall Blevins, and Tanika Johnson. The sixth victim is a minor. His name was withheld. This killing comes while many are still processing the loss of life in the mass shooting this weekend in Colorado Springs, where a gunman killed five at an LGBTQ nightclub. Yet another of the gun tragedies in America that far exceed any other developed nation. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm William Brangham.
For some reaction to this shooting and others in the past 2 weeks, I spoke earlier with Virginia State Senator Louise Lucas. She's a Democrat whose district includes the area where today's shooting happened. Senator Louise Lucas, thank you so much for joining us. First of all, our condolences to your community to be going through this, yet another shooting in Virginia. Have you learned anything new in the last few hours about what happened, about the motive of the shooter, the weapon, and so forth?
Nothing yet, Judy. The only thing we know is that the investigation is ongoing, and that the local law enforcement officers are gathering information as best they can, trying to put it all together, a meeting with the families, trying to provide counseling and whatever other comfort services they can for them to try to get them through this. I mean, just imagine, if you will, how these families are feeling on today, on the day before Thanksgiving, and tomorrow they're going to have empty seats at the table at a time when they should be hugging their loved ones and giving thanks for all that we have together. And I just can't tell you just how upset I have been about this. But the thing that grieves me as much is the fact that we have within our power to enact some common sense gun prevention measures and have failed to do it. And I think that is the thing that we need to most think about, pray about, and try to energize a critical mass of people to contact their legislators about. And that is to stop this gun violence. And the only way that can happen, Judy, is through legislative action. And it needs to take place, and it needs to take place now. How many more people have to die before legislative bodies all around this country understand that we are the ones who can control these guns and have people have such ready access to them?
And I do want to ask you about that, because we know just a couple of years ago, Virginia passed a number of gun control measures, including stricter background checks. We just looked at the list. So what does that say to you that you do have laws on the books in Virginia? In fact, I saw that the group Every Town for Gun Safety rates Virginia, I believe it's 14th in the country, best in terms of its gun control measures.
Obviously, we have not done a good enough job of trying to keep guns out of the hands of people who should not have them. And I'm not just talking about people who have mental health issues, because I know that's one of the first things that people will harp on. But we need to do a better job of making sure that people don't have such easy access to guns. That's the problem. I mean, there's just too many guns in the hands of people who should not have them.
Could I just ask you, what specific law would you like to see on the books, either at the state or the federal level, that you think might have prevented what happened, not just in Chesapeake, but at the University of Virginia the other day?
Well, you know what? President Biden has introduced legislation. The thing of it is, it just doesn't go far enough, because he doesn't have the will or the backbone of the members of Congress to make it go to the extent that it needs to go to make sure that we get these guns out of the hands of people who should not have them. There are measures on the books, but most of them do not go far enough. And I'm saying until the members of Congress and the members of legislative bodies all around this country come to the understanding that we have the controls over how this legislation gets introduced and passed, we can stop this senseless gun violence by introducing legislation that limits the number of handguns that people have, and especially those people who should not have them in the first place.
And when you say members of either a state legislature or of the Congress, whom are you speaking about in particular? Are you pointing a finger at one political party or another? I mean, who is responsible here?
Well, I'm trying not to point fingers here, because I'm trying not to make this political. But if you look at the gun control or gun prevention measures that were introduced in the legislature, all you got to do is go down that list and you see who voted yay and who voted nay. And so without calling names, I just want to say I and some members of my caucus introduced an omnibus package of gun prevention measures to include universal background checks, as I've indicated. But I think they just don't go far enough. We need to beat them up. It's not working. What we've done is not working, so we need to do more.
Do you think the public is behind you? Most American people, most Virginians are behind you on wanting to get these laws changed, Senator Lucas?
I absolutely think they are, because I think everybody understands that a person with a gun that should not have one does not care the community that they go into. So if you think your school is exempt, or your church or your synagogue or your grocery store or your Walmart is exempt, then think again, because these things are happening every day all across the country, and who knows what community is going to be hit next. Yes, I think the vast majority of people are behind us. I just hope that there's a critical mass who will talk to the members of their legislative bodies, who will talk to whomever is in a position of authority to help bring about some of these measures to make sure that we can stop this senseless mass murders.
Well, as As we said at the outset, our condolences are with you, with your community, as you go through yet another tragic shooting. State Senator Louise Lucas in Virginia, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me on.
In the day's other news, the Colorado Springs shooting suspect had a first court appearance in the killing of five people at a gay nightclub. During the conference call, Anderson Lee Aldrich was slumped in a wheelchair behind defense lawyers. Police say that Aldrich was beaten by nightclub patrons during the attack. The charges could include murder and hate crimes. The U.S. Justice Department reportedly wants to interview former Vice President Pence in its January 6th investigation. The New York Times and others say the focus is on then-President Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 election results. Mr. Pence is said to be open to considering the request. In Ukraine, a new onslaught of Russian missiles knocked out power to most of the country today and claimed more lives. The airstrikes blasted Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, killing at least three people. In the south, a missile struck a hospital maternity ward and brought more tragedy.
A doctor was pulled out from under the rubble, and with the help of a ladder, a new mother was evacuated from the second floor. Unfortunately, her newborn died, who was just 2 days old.
Meanwhile, the U.S. authorized another $400 million in military aid for Ukraine for a total of $19 billion so far. Bombs exploded today near two bus stops in Jerusalem, killing one person and wounding at least 18. The attacks came at the height of rush hour. Israeli police blame Palestinian militants, and officials closed two West Bank crossings. Later, the Israelis said that troops had killed two Palestinians in an overnight clash. In Indonesia, rescuers are still searching for survivors of Monday's earthquake that killed at least 271 people. Fire department video did show one moment of hope today. A six-year-old boy lifted to safety after being trapped for 3 days. He was found in the rubble of his home. Police in central China beat workers today as they protested over pay and anti-COVID measures outside of the world's largest Apple iPhone factory. Witnesses posted cell phone video of the confrontation. The sometimes shaky footage showed thousands of protesters at the factory. Police in hazmat suits could be seen attacking and hitting them with batons. The United Kingdom's Supreme Court has ruled that Scotland may not hold an independence vote without the British government's approval. The semi-autonomous Scottish government had wanted a referendum next October. Scotland's First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, said today's ruling is not the end of it.
We must and we will find another democratic, lawful and constitutional means by which the Scottish people can express their will. In my view, that can only be an election. The next national election scheduled for Scotland is, of course, the UK general election.
Scottish voters rejected independence in a 2014 referendum. Britain's ruling Conservative Party has refused to approve a new vote. Back in this country, the Georgia Supreme Court today reinstated a state ban on abortions after about 6 weeks of pregnancy. It will stay in place while the court considers rulings on the merits of the law. A lower court had overturned the ban. The Georgia court also agreed today to allow early voting this Saturday in the U.S. Senate runoff. The contest features incumbent Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock against Republican Herschel Walker, a former college football and NFL star. Republicans have secured another California seat in the next U.S. House of Representatives. Kevin Kiley was declared the winner in his race last night. That gives the GOP 220 seats in the House, two more than a majority, with three races yet to be called. And on Wall Street, stocks advanced as the Federal Reserve signaled that it might scale back future interest rate hikes. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 96 points to close at 34,196. The Nasdaq rose nearly 111 points, 1%. The S&P 500 added 23. Still to come on the NewsHour, Congress passes a law banning non-disclosure agreements in sexual harassment cases. Taiwan's deputy foreign minister discusses his country's increasingly fraught relations with China. A training program started in New Mexico helps doctors around the world, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
3 weeks ago, Pakistan's former Prime Minister Imran Khan survived an assassination attempt, although he was wounded in the leg. Khan was ousted from office in April of this year after 3.5 years in office. Ever since, his PTI Populist Political Party has made significant gains in regional elections, and he draws massive crowds to his rallies, where he demands early elections, calls out corruption, and points fingers at the powerful Pakistani military for his removal. He spoke with Amna Nawaz this morning ahead of another massive march to Islamabad on Saturday. She asked him how he's doing since the attack.
Well, Amna, I was very lucky. I had 3 bullets on my right leg and some shrapnel on my left. So the flesh wounds are healing well, but the bone, where my bone got cracked by the 3rd bullet, that's causing me a bit of a discomfort. But, you know, I expect in the next 2-3 weeks I should be walking, putting weight on my leg.
We should mention the protest march that you've been leading, which should end up at the Capitol at your direction, is to call for early elections, which you've been calling for since you were ousted in a no-confidence vote by Parliament back in April. But there are those that argue that your protests and your disruptions, which have gone on since you were ousted, actually disrupt the political and economic stability of the country. There are scheduled to be elections by next summer, I believe. So why not wait until then and run?
Well, Amna, first of all, none of my activities have been disruptive. We have public rallies. People come to the rallies. We, what is our democratic and constitutional right, we talk about the injustice that is taking place in this country, where these this cabal of crooks have been foisted on us. And secondly, the economy has gone to the ground. Financial markets outside Pakistan and within the country have lost confidence in this government. And all our economic indicators are going down. So if they don't hold elections immediately, it doesn't bother my party because we are gaining all the time. But our worry is that they will leave the country in a state where it will be beyond anyone's control.
On this march, you have mobilized thousands and thousands of people to head towards the capital city. How worried are you about the possibility of violence once they get to the capital city, and what can you do to stop it, if so?
Amna, I have done almost 60 to 65 rallies since in the last 7 months since I've been out of power. Never has any of my rallies been violent. The only time there was disruption was when this assassination attempt took place. Saturday, when we go to Pindi, actually, rather than Islamabad, it will be a completely peaceful protest. The reason why my strength has grown in Pakistan, why the party has got bigger with time, is because the government has flopped. Now, if it goes the whole way, fine, we will wait. My only concern is that, the way things are going, we could be heading towards chaos. I mean, economic chaos.
But experts who look more broadly say the country's economic dysfunction is not just about any one government. It is systemic. So you were in power for 3.5 years. What did you do to address those problems while you were in office?
The two parties have been in power in Pakistan for 30 years. And 30 years, the military governments have been in power. My party came, we only had 3.5 years in government. We broke all records of exports in Pakistan. And our tax collection was the highest in our history. So we were heading in the right direction.
You have repeatedly accused the United States of conspiring to remove you from office. You also said America treats Pakistan, quote, like a slave. But then a few days ago, in a recent interview with the Financial Times, you said all of that is, quote, over. It's behind me. You indicated you would like to have a good relationship with the United States. So why the U-turn?
I'm not firsty. I mean, it's just a fact that the Pakistan-U.S. relationship has been lopsided. I mean, you know, it is not, for instance, the U.S.-India relationship, which I call a very civilized relationship, a dignified relationship. In Pakistan, you know, we have been, well, the war on terror, we were like a hired gun. And I think it is a very undignified relationship.
If you were to win office, do you believe you could have a good working relationship with the United States?
You know, the United States is a democracy. Democracies accept criticism. You know, democracies accept other people's point of view. Master slaves don't. Pakistan's relationship with the U.S. is very important for us. So just because, you know, the regime change, it shouldn't mean that I should have not in future any relationship with the U.S. And yes, I have my right to criticize.
What about in neighboring Afghanistan? When the Taliban reclaimed power last year, you seemed to welcome them back into power. They have dramatically curtailed rights for women. Today marks 429 days since teenage girls were banned from entering classrooms. Were you wrong to support their return to power?
What happens in Afghanistan affects Pakistan. Pakistan needs peace to develop its economy. And then if there's peace in Afghanistan, then Pakistan's future of connecting ourselves economically to Central Asia, it can only happen if there's peace in Afghanistan.
But, sir, peace at what cost?
40 years people in Afghanistan have suffered. So all our interest is peace, whichever government comes in. For the first time, there is peace in Afghanistan. Now, about human rights, I mean, what is the world going to do? Am I justifying it? All I'm saying is, what should we do about it? Are we going to invade Afghanistan again to liberate the women? What are we going to do? The best way is to engage with them, bring them in the mainstream, and then put pressure on them and hope that the people of Afghanistan, and especially the women of Afghanistan, they're strong enough to assert their rights. Give them time.
In the last year plus, have you encouraged those leaders to let girls back into school?
No. There is no communication. So, I mean, if there's communication, we would talk about girls' education and so on.
But do you believe that they should let girls back into school? You have a platform here. If you were to deliver a message to them now, what would you say?
Look, of course, Amna, in Pakistan, in KP, which is the bordering province to Afghanistan, we give special stipends to parents who send their girls for education. We believe firmly that it's women education that actually builds societies.
That is the former Prime Minister of Pakistan, Imran Khan, joining us today. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Amna.
A piece of legislation limiting the enforcement of non-disclosure agreements in sexual harassment disputes is headed to President Biden's desk for his signature after the House of Representatives passed it in a bipartisan vote. Lisa Desjardins has our report on the Speak Out Act and who it will impact most.
Roughly one-third of American workers are bound by some form of a non-disclosure agreement, or NDA, preventing what they can say about their work experience. The Speak Out Act, about to become law, would mean that NDAs signed when employees take their job could no longer stop them from speaking out about sexual harassment or abuse. It's a systemic change coming directly from the Me Too movement and from this woman, Julie Roginski, co-founder of Lift Our Voices, a nonprofit dedicated to ending workplace rules that favor harassers and abusers. Julie, thank you for joining me. Help us understand, how many workers would the Speak Out Act affect, and roughly how?
Well, we don't know because we're not sure how many workers are actually bound by these kinds of by these kinds of NDAs, primarily because they're secretive, right? You're not even allowed to say that you have an NDA. So for a lot of workers, they're not even allowed to tell you that they have one. And ultimately, what it's going to do is help, we estimate, millions and millions of workers not just talk about their own experiences, but also talk about experiences that they may have witnessed. There are plenty of people who've been witnesses to horrible instances of sexual harassment and sexual assault who simply aren't able right now to even share with their colleagues or even with the survivor what they've seen, what they know, in order to stop the predatory behavior. And this bill will make sure that those people will be able to speak out about it publicly.
Now, this is not retroactive, and that means that, for example, you are not going to be able to, because of this law, speak about what you experienced at Fox News because of the NDA you signed there, and the same for your co-founder, Gretchen Carlson. But to the degree that you can you help us with what your experience is about how these NDAs work, what they do?
I was actually bound by two NDAs in my life. One was, as you said, with Fox News, and that's a post-dispute NDA, which this bill doesn't apply to. That means it was signed as part of a settlement. The other NDA that I was bound to was with the governor of New Jersey, Governor Phil Murphy, and that was on the first day of work. And of course, an NDA like this would absolutely apply to that case, because in that instance, I was a witness to horrible toxicity on his campaign. I spoke to him about it. I confided in him that if he didn't get it under control, something bad was going to happen. And sure enough, something did happen. A young woman came to me about a year later and told me that she'd been sexually assaulted by one of my colleagues. Instead of being able to talk to her about it, I was reminded by his attorneys, by Governor Murphy's attorneys over and over, that I couldn't speak to her because I was bound by an NDA. I couldn't tell her anything I had witnessed, anything I had experienced, or even really tell her that she wasn't alone, that I'd heard of other women who were in similar situations. Mm-hmm. That was an incredibly heartbreaking moment in my life, because here you have a young woman who's coming to you asking for help, and you can't even tell her why you can't help her, because my NDA was so broad, I couldn't even tell her I had an NDA. And so as a result of that experience, that really motivated me to make sure this was never going to happen to anybody else. That's why Gretchen and I got together to form Lift Our Voices. That was my experience that really motivated me to form Lift Our Voices. And that was my experience that really motivated me to make sure that the Speak Out Act was never going to prevent one more person from being able to tell their own stories or the stories of other people.
You did touch on one thing, though. This act would not change any non-disclosure agreements that are signed as part of a settlement. Are you worried that that could be a means to pressure people who are suffering abuse and still kind of have that code of silence enforced?
Well, certainly this bill doesn't do everything we wanted. From the perspective of Lift Our Voices, our organization, we strongly believe that you should have no NDAs whatsoever for any kind of toxic workplace experiences, and this bill doesn't go that far. What this bill does do is make sure that if you are suffering from sexual harassment or sexual assault, or you're witnessing those things happening to you or to somebody else, what you're able to now do is talk about it publicly before you file a lawsuit, before you have to actually go to court to state your case. And that's so important for so many people because they don't necessarily want to file a lawsuit. What most women, in my experience, want to do is just to continue working, but they want to be able to warn others about predators in their midst. They want to be able to warn others about perils that they may be encountering, or just to have somebody to talk to about what's happening to them at work. You know, right now, these NDAs are so broad, you can't talk to your colleagues, to your loved ones, sometimes to your priest, to your rabbi, to your therapist, to anybody about what's happening to you. What this means is now you can if you've suffered from sexual harassment or sexual assault. And that's so important from not just from the perspective of a good workplace experience, but also from the perspective of just making sure that people are able to get this off their chest and confide in others about what's happening to them.
This is coming just after the 5-year anniversary of the Me Too hashtag, really just opening up the public view on the scope and scale of sexual assault and harassment in our society. But I wonder now, 5 years later, where do you think we are with the recognition and attention to those issues?
We strongly believe at Lift Our Voices that we're making progress. We just passed a forced arbitration bill earlier this year that the president signed that precludes people from having to go to forced arbitration if they've been sexually harassed or sexually assaulted. We just passed the Speak Out Act, and we're not going to stop. And I think for those people who think the Me Too movement was a flash in the pan and the public has moved on, you see that that's not the case. Not only are we passing federal legislation, but we're also passing legislation at the state level. In 2019, New Jersey became the first state in the nation to get rid of NDAs for all toxic workplace issues. The same thing happened in California and Washington State. And companies are paying attention as a result of that Washington state law passing. Microsoft, for example, got rid of NDAs for their global workforce. So the Me Too movement is full steam ahead. It is not a flash in the pan for all the setbacks that people sometimes see. Look, sometimes it's one step back, but two steps forward. And this is not a passing fad. We are going to get this done and make sure that women can work with dignity every single day without having to worry about harassment, assault, or any other Me Too issues that we've heard so much about in the past 5, 6, 7 years.
I know you're also working on racial, aging, gender, all kinds of other discrimination as well. So we will stay tuned. Julie Roginski of Lift Our Voices, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
The people of Taiwan will head to the polls this weekend for local elections. But the vote comes as mainland China has ramped up threatening military activity around Taiwan, which it views as a breakaway province. Nick Schifrin has more on these ongoing tensions in the region and U.S. involvement.
For years, the People's Liberation Army has been training and modernizing to meet what the U.S. says is a singular goal: be able to invade Taiwan and beat back any U.S. response by 2027. That date, set by President, General Secretary, and Supreme Commander Xi Jinping last month at the 20th Communist Party Congress, he reiterated his vow to reunify one way or another.
We insist on striving for the prospect of peaceful reunification with the greatest sincerity and with the greatest effort. However, we are not committed to abandoning the use of force, and we reserve the option of taking all necessary measures.
The 2022 has provided Beijing a warning and Taiwan a model. A small, agile army can stand up to a superpower. Taiwan's military is one-tenth the size of China's, and the war in Ukraine has highlighted efforts to embrace an agile defense. With expanded missiles, improved air defense, and increased surveillance and reconnaissance. Last weekend at the Halifax International Security Forum, I sat down with Taiwan's Deputy Foreign Minister, Ming Yen Tsai.
In Taiwan, we watch the situation in Ukraine closely, and we would continue to beef up our defense so as to raise the cost for the potential invasion from the other side of the Taiwan Strait.
U.S. officials recently visited Taipei, I was told, to talk about some of the lessons from the Ukraine war. What did they tell you?
In the battlefield of Ukraine, we can see it's very important you need to hold solidarity to fight back. You may know that on a daily basis, we suffer military intimidation, economic coercion, political infiltration, cyber strike, disinformation campaign, and the international blockade.
You're increasing defense spending about 14% up to 2.4% of GDP. A former Pacific commander in the U.S. told us that's not enough. That the U.S. shouldn't come to your aid until you can prove you'll be able to lead your own resistance. Can you?
Yes, I think it would be never enough. But we need to use our limited resources in a very smart way. And that's the reason why Taiwan also carry on our reforms for our long-term military structure. And the purpose is to make Taiwanese military forces more resilient, more agile.
A Russian defeat in Ukraine, Ming Yen Tsai says, would help deter Beijing.
It's very important for we international partners to hold a spirit of solidarity, to raise the price for Russia's invasion. If we failed, I'm afraid China may copy that kind of model to do the same thing to its neighborhood.
The Biden administration has approved 6 packages of military aid to Taiwan, along with trainers. But that training is limited to how to operate the weapons.
You're not conducting field or fleet exercises. Do you think there should be?
We would like to have all kinds of contact and cooperation with our American counterparts between our military forces. That would be very helpful.
It sounds like you're asking for more training.
If we can have that would be more than welcome.
And are you concerned, or would you be concerned, that that would actually provoke Beijing and make war more likely if the U.S. were to increase its training with Taiwan?
China only understands the language of politics.
So are you saying that the United States would come to Taiwan's defense if China attacked?
Yes, we have a commitment to do that.
Right, on 3 separate occasions.
Are you willing to get involved militarily to defend Taiwan if it comes to that?
Yes.
You are?
That's a commitment we made.
President Biden has rhetorically broken with four decades of U.S. strategic ambiguity about whether the U.S. will defend Taiwan.
Our one China policy has not changed.
Last week, despite his own comments, he reiterated the U.S., quote, acknowledges the Chinese position that there is but one China and Taiwan is part of China.
What does Taiwan expect the U.S. to do right now if Beijing were to invade?
The first priority of Taiwan's consideration and the expectation for the cooperation with the United States is to take some joint efforts to deter war, rather than to wait the war from happening and then to take some joint action.
I wonder if I could ask you about, go back to Ukraine and ask you about a fundamental lesson that some in the U.S. are taking about reducing the ambiguity of whether the U.S. would support Taiwan to deter war. Do you agree?
What we sense in Taiwan is U.S. commitment to Taiwan security is becoming clearer than ever. So we will continue to use this momentum to deepen security partnership between our two sides.
There is momentum, but would you rather see a change in U.S. policy giving up strategic ambiguity?
Actually, Taiwan realized that it's our responsibility to safeguard our sovereignty and democracy. So we will continue our endeavor to beef up our defense capacity, and we would also invite stronger support from our international partners so as to make Beijing understand that Taiwan is not alone.
Deputy Foreign Minister, thank you very much.
Thank you so much to be here.
The recent International Climate Summit put a spotlight on the problem of methane emissions, which are responsible for about 30% of the planet's warming. More countries are pledging to reduce those emissions, and the United Nations is creating a methane detection program using satellite technology. But methane leaks remain a serious problem, particularly at a time when the U.S. has increased oil and natural gas production. Science correspondent Miles O'Brien reports on the challenge of tracking the emissions and why they are higher than is publicly disclosed.
The road to zero greenhouse gas emissions begins here, in a place where we are hurtling faster and faster in the opposite direction. This is the Permian Basin, the largest oil field in America, 86,000 square miles spanning Texas and New Mexico. There are tens of thousands of oil wells here. Current production is about 5.5 million barrels a day. It will likely double in a few years.
This is happening because they developed the technology to frack oil and gas from shale. If they hadn't done that, we would have converted to clean energy a long time ago.
Sharon Wilson is an environmental activist who is bearing witness to an ongoing greenhouse gas disaster in the Permian Basin. When oil rises to the surface under pressure, it comes with a witch's brew of hydrocarbon gases, including methane, also under pressure. Methane traps about 80 times more heat during a 20-year lifetime than carbon dioxide. It is responsible for about 30% of human-caused global warming. Permian is the largest methane-emitting oil and gas basin in the U.S.
So to put this in perspective, there are global consequences to this.
Absolutely. I mean, we are harming the entire planet and every person and every living thing on it by what we're doing here in Texas. And we call this a climate bomb.
It is an invisible, odorless bomb. Working with the nonprofit Earthworks, Sharon is using a $100,000 camera that gives her superpower vision.
See all that movement there? That's all pollution.
The camera records the spectral signature of hydrocarbons and volatile organic compounds. So what looks like this in visible light becomes this in Sharon's viewfinder.
I am seeing a lot of methane blasting out from that flare that is barely lit.
Even though methane is the primary ingredient of natural gas, here in the Permian Basin, it is mostly considered waste. To reduce methane emissions, operators are supposed to burn it in flare stacks like these. This converts methane, CH4, into CO2, reducing its impact on the climate crisis.
but frequently the flare stacks flicker, falter, or fail.
Unfortunately, this is not unusual. There's just way too much methane going into our atmosphere.
But how much? Flying over the Permian Basin with a spectrometer, the nonprofit Carbon Mapper found 1,100 super emitters of methane here. The organization is pushing an effort to launch satellites able to pinpoint large methane emissions. Natasha Miles is also interested in the big picture. She is a professor of atmospheric science at Pennsylvania State University. She and colleague Scott Richardson maintain a growing network of monitoring sites outside oil company fence lines to measure methane.
We've set up 5 towers where we measure methane concentrations, and then we combine that with weather models to figure out where the emissions are coming from and how that's changing in time.
State and federal regulators rely on the oil and gas industry to detect and report its own methane emissions. The industry says it has done selective surveys and found the leak occurrence rate is less than 1%. But independent researchers dispute that.
We've found that in certain locations, it can be up to 5 times wrong, 5 times too low.
So the industry is underreporting.
Right.
No surprise to Sharon Wilson.
So we're going to need the tripod.
She took us to an oil and gas production site in Reeves County. The horizontal pipes on top of these tanks are part of a vapor recovery system designed to capture hydrocarbon gases, including methane, to be sold or burned in a flare stack. But the thermal image proved beyond doubt that the system is not doing its job.
Definitely not working. There's just methane coming up everywhere. Huge plume, massive. And I want you to see it. God.
The air here was thick with the smell of hydrogen sulfide, giving us headaches and nausea. The site is a repeat offender. Sharon has recorded methane emissions here 21 times since April of 2019. She has submitted 9 complaints with video evidence to the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality. The agency says it has conducted 3 investigations, and in February of 2021, fined the company all of $1,875. Ownership of the site changed hands in September of 2021. The new owner says it has substantially reduced emissions. But when Sharon returned here in October, 2 months after our visit, she recorded a hydrocarbon plume every bit as large as the one we saw. The company says that leak has been repaired, and the TCEQ says it is conducting yet another investigation. So why are state regulators seemingly unable to stop these ongoing emissions?
It's the Wild West out here, right?
For nearly 29 years, environmental scientist Tim Doty worked for the TCEQ. We met him at an oil production site in Pecos. Again, there is a vapor recovery system here, ostensibly to capture the methane and either burn it or sell it. And again, there was a huge plume of methane emissions.
So does this state regulate methane emissions in any sort of meaningful way?
No. Oil and gas industry in the state of Texas and nationwide is basically uncontrolled. It's built on the honor system, right? And some companies can be good, and many of them aren't.
Identifying and locating the owners of some of these facilities can be difficult. So we sent some questions to the American Petroleum Institute, a leading industry trade group. While it did not address specific cases, API says the industry is taking actions to detect and reduce methane emissions across the supply chain, supports the direct regulation of methane for new and existing sources, and vows to work with the EPA to develop and finalize regulations that further the progress made in reducing emissions. At the UN climate meeting in Egypt, President Biden announced the long-delayed EPA regulations. The rule aims to ensure that wells are monitored for leaks, allow use of innovative detection technologies, leverage data from remote sensors, and require that flares are properly operated. The TCEQ says a decision on whether Texas will submit a plan to adhere to the new EPA rule will be made after it is finalized. Regardless, the federal rule is not enough to satisfy Sharon Wilson. What, in your view, is the solution?
The best available control technology for methane is to keep it in the ground. Never drill that hole in the first place, because once you drill that hole, that's where it all starts.
One person, one camera, determined to ensure the methane problem does not remain invisible. And so she keeps driving down the long, lonely road to zero. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Miles O'Brien near Pecos, Texas.
Millions of Americans live in rural or other underserved areas known as care deserts, where there are few medical care facilities and few doctors with specialized expertise. As Fred DeSam Lazaro reports from New Mexico, one doctor is trying to help change that.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah, just relax. Yeah. Now take a deep breath.
It was cases like these that inspired gastroenterologist Sanjeev Arora's idea.
You know, your liver really feels good.
58-year-old Robert Subia contracted hepatitis C, a viral liver infection, from a blood transfusion decades ago.
Hello, Mr. Robert. How are you?
Regular appointments and scans of his liver are critical to his recovery.
Wow.
Which appears to be going well.
This is amazing results.
Need to lose some weight, exercise, which I don't do, and eat better.
So we can reduce the fatty liver so we don't get close to cirrhosis.
This has to move back.
Robert Subia has the strong support of his wife, Florence, and he's lucky in another way. They live close to this Albuquerque center.
About a third of New Mexico's residents live in its vast rural areas, where a trip to get specialized medical care can often mean a day-long journey or even overnight. That's not affordable for a lot of people in a region which has one of the highest rates of poverty in the United States.
It was one case in particular that haunted Dr. Arora, a single mother with two young children whose home was a five-hour drive from his clinic.
She had cancer of the liver, and she passed away 6 months later, leaving these two children. I was asking myself, you know, why did she die? And the answer was she died because the right knowledge didn't exist at the right place at the right time. And this was not an isolated case.
At the time, amid a Hep C epidemic, Dr. Arora was one of very few specialists treating it. His appointment calendar stretched out 8 months.
I think you had just started talking about it, and I'd love to hear more.
That's when he says the idea came to him to, quote, democratize that knowledge, have specialists use technology and share their expertise with rural providers so they could treat their patients much closer to home. He dubbed it Project ECHO, Extension for Community Healthcare Outcomes.
I don't like people to exercise when they're feeling really tired.
His vision is to move beyond the model of one doctor, in this case a specialist in an urban medical center, working with one patient.
To see somebody in a rural area, they see one less patient in the urban area. The total number of patients doesn't go up. We need an exponential improvement in capacity to deliver best practice care. That is where something like ECHO comes in, where we multiply expertise.
It really helps sort of level the playing field, I think, in medicine.
It is all set. Mm-hmm.
Dr. Alethea Gabrielis practices at the Gallup Indian Medical Center, about a two-hour drive from Albuquerque.
We were able to treat a lot of people that have been waiting years to be able to access treatment. We were able to cure a lot of patients. I had the same knowledge as, you know, a high-level hepatologist at the University of New Mexico to be able to bring that new resource to my patients.
Is it safe to say it's literally saved lives of your patients?
Absolutely.
ECHO uses a hub and spoke design to connect a team of specialists, the hub, to multiple participants in the spokes via Zoom during regularly scheduled sessions that include discussions on specific cases and mentorship.
This man has one of the most complex cases of multidrug resistance.
Dr. Gabrielis, who completed a fellowship in infectious disease, credits ECHO for keeping her up to date on how to treat a wide variety of challenging conditions, like that of 27-year-old Dana Quintero.
I ended up, you know, being in ICU, for about like a whole week, I think. That's whenever Dr. Gabrielis walked into my room and she was like, you have an infection, it's called A strep.
Even though this was a fairly serious infectious disease, I felt, you know, 100% confident doing that kind of care here because I have instant access to those academic medical centers through ECHO.
Since its creation nearly 20 years ago, Project ECHO's presence has multiplied across the globe. There are now 792 hubs operating in 69 countries, focusing on dozens of specialties. It is supported entirely by grants from government and private sources.
One of the first places that Project ECHO expanded was in Dr. Arora's native India, a country with myriad public health challenges which have taken a back seat during COVID. Among the campaigns using the ECHO platform is the fight against tuberculosis, which has surged in recent times.
Tuberculosis is preventable and in most cases curable, and reaching vulnerable populations is key to reducing the number of cases. Last year, more than 500,000 people died from TB in India. The government has pledged to eliminate TB by 2025, and Dr. Kamal Chopra at the New Delhi Tuberculosis Center says the ECHO model will be key.
It speeds up our reach to the community. By this ECHO platform, at our national level, attendance goes up to 800.
800 in a single meeting?
Yes, in a single meeting.
In central Delhi, Neera and Preeti are among hundreds of volunteers who visit patients in their homes. Recovered from TB themselves, they say they use their ECHO training to help patients manage their medication and watch other family members who may be vulnerable.
We tell them not to ignore even trivial symptoms, fever or cold. They need to go in and consult with the doctor immediately and get a diagnosis or get medicine.
Also, those people who have HIV or diabetes are more likely to get TB because their bodies have been weakened.
This democratization of best practices is not a healthcare issue alone.
Dr. Arora is now trying to expand ECHO into education.
When I look at my own life, what made the huge difference to make me who I am today? It was education. And I really would like to give that opportunity to every child. We have the technology backbone. We have the model.
So far, they've started 8 education ECHO programs with some 3,000 participating K-12 teachers from across the state of New Mexico. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Fred DeSamlazaro in New Mexico.
And a reminder that Fred's reporting is a partnership with the Undertold Stories Project at the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota. And as Americans gather for Thanksgiving tomorrow, we know some conversations with friends and family could be contentious. So online, we explore how best to approach difficult topics by setting respectful boundaries. That is at pbs.org/newshour. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, whether you're traveling or at home this Thanksgiving, and we'll see you soon.